This is Radio Boston. I'm Steve Brown. If you're a high schooler in the Commonwealth, study up. Just got harder for you to graduate. That's because the state's Board of Elementary and Secondary Education just raised the passing score on the 10th grade Massachusetts Comprehensive Assessment System, or MCAS. Monday's vote will impact the incoming freshman class this fall, with a further approval to raise it again for the class of 2031. With us to give us more context to this change is WBUR education reporter Max Larkin. Max, hi.
Hi, Steve.
So, Max, the MCAS has been a hot-button issue for a long time. So how big of a deal is this change, and what does it mean for the students?
I think that's subject to debate here, Steve. Before the vote on Monday, board members kind of downplayed how big a deal this is. They said, you know, certainly even after passing scores climb, most kids are going to pass this test statewide. But in some communities, high immigrant, high linguistic diversity, it's liable to be a lot more. You've got 30 or 40, sometimes nearly 50% struggling to pass already in places like, say, Lawrence or Chelsea.
Mm. Well, coming up in a few minutes, we'll hear from some more invested parties. But generally, what are you hearing from those in favor and against the change?
Well, I think people who support this believe that a rigorous exit exam is maybe the keystone of Massachusetts' first-in-the-nation educational performance. So higher expectations translate into better results, they'd say. And then, you know, if you have a number of students climbing year over year that's passing, you might start to worry, Steve, about the rigor of the test. And moreover, they'd say the state's education reform law, still on the books, requires at least this assessment of students' mastery, and they feel this better lives up to the charge. On the other hand, you've got legislators like Senator Pat Jaylen of Somerville. She spearheaded a petition of 98 lawmakers asking the state education department not to take this step. And she says the law isn't so clear about how this test should work, Steve.
There is certainly nothing that says you need to make sure that more kids don't pass, because raising the standard doesn't mean kids are going to learn more, for sure.
Now, Jaylen is concerned that in communities with, say, a lot of frontline workers that were hard hit by the pandemic, this will cause or exacerbate a dropout crisis among the students who fail. And for those who just struggle, it will kind of narrow down the curriculum to focus on the test even more than it does now.
Max, let's just take a step back if we can. Give us a little history of the MCAS in Massachusetts. Who takes it? What does it measure? And what happens if they don't pass?
Yeah, it's been a feature of state law for almost 30 years and kicked in as an exit exam a little later. It's a multi-section assessment system that's supposed to measure how well you've absorbed the content in all your K-12 classes. So it's taken pretty much every year from 3rd to 10th grade. And since 2002 or 3, that 10th grade test has been called, has been a so-called exit exam in that you have to pass it to graduate. Students who don't pass it, Steve, do have some options. They can retake the test, they can appeal, or if they have a good enough score, they can submit what's called an educational proficiency plan, an EPP, they call it. And they can sort of show they know their stuff from teacher input and grades and may just not test well. But I do want to say, failing the MCAS can be a demonstrably heavy weight, Steve. It can discourage students, and it can lead them to drop out. And to be sure, more students are going to fail once these new thresholds go into effect.
Wasn't the MCAS originally created to make sure that individual schools were up to snuff? But then the pressure and high stakes got shifted over to the students.
Well, I think the test has always done both. You know, just as when students don't do well on the test, there's a wait for districts that struggle on it, schools that struggle on it. You still have three whole districts under state control in large part because of their low MCAS scores. That'd be Lawrence, Holyoke, and Southbridge. But even under state control, Steve, their improvement on MCAS has been slow and I think mixed at best.
Has it always been this controversial?
No, I think this is a new and sort of extraordinary moment. The pandemic made the physical act of sitting for a standardized test a lot more complicated. Then you had the MCAS suspended for a couple of years. Many colleges went test optional in their admissions policies. And so I think there's a sort of question suddenly in a lot of minds. Do we really need these high stakes tests, or at least do we need them as much as we thought we did?
Okay. Max, hang tight if you would. I want to bring in two more voices now. With me is Jonathan Guzman. He's the vice chair of the Lawrence School Committee, and Paul Revel, former Massachusetts Secretary of Education under Governor Deval Patrick. Jonathan, Paul, thank you for coming in today.
Thank you for having us.
Jonathan, I want to start with you. You spoke with WBUR's Max Larkin last month about MCAS and your experience with it. You came to the U.S. mainland a decade ago as a non-native English speaker. You excelled in school in Puerto Rico but faced challenges when you got to Lawrence High School, where within weeks you were expected to take the 10th grade MCAS test. This was back in 2011. You failed the first time. Eventually, you passed on your second attempt. You went on to get a degree in biology from Fitchburg State University. If you came to Lawrence High today in 2022 with these increased passing scores, do you think your track would be different?
It would not. Mm-hmm. I feel like in particular, when students get placed into this type of corner, right, that they don't have the skills when they're entering the country in particular, and they are struggling right now because they're trying to learn a language. What happened to me in particular was that I was placed in a room with a dictionary and basically got 2 hours because I had an IEP, and that gave me the extra time. So during that time in particular, I spent most of the time trying to analyze what those words meant. And when I put them together, I didn't even understand if the sentences or the question that they were asking me, I was going to answer correctly. So at the end, I did fail it. It brought my self-intention of moving to America for a better future, for a better education, and really put my family into question, did we do the correct move? Did we really left everything in our, you know, in a territory of the United States, Puerto Rico, but our country for a better education? And now I'm reflecting differently than what it's supposed to be.
Mm-hmm. Paul Revel, you're in favor of these increases. We know stories like Jonathan's aren't unique, and they highlight what many parents and teachers are worried about when it comes to raising passing scores. Here's a scene from The Wire, which explains these concerns.
All this so we score higher on the state tests? If we're teaching the kids the test questions, what is it assessing in them?
Nothing. It assesses us. The test scores go up, they can say the schools are improving. The scores stay down, they can't.
Juking the stats.
Okay, those are teachers and students on the show The Wire. Paul, what would you say to worries that raising scores pushes teachers to teach to the test? Does this mean that we're moving away from teaching the whole person?
Well, let me take a step back, if I might, sure. Steve. I'm a big Wire fan, by the way. I'm watching it again for the first time in 20 years. You know, I was present at the creation of the Education Reform Act of 1993 and worked a lot with the team that got it through the legislature. Fundamentally, at the heart of the notion that we would measure progress in schools for individuals as well as schools was a concept of fairness. And we've been arguing. Reasonable people will disagree about fairness over time. The question really boils down to whether or not the fair thing to do is to give every child what they need to develop the skills and competencies to be successful in college and career, no matter how much time or how much money it takes the system to do that. Or is it fairer to acknowledge that they've worked hard, they're well-intentioned, they've shown up, and therefore they deserve a diploma whether or not they have the skills to do it? So equity, in my view, reasonable people can disagree about this, but when I hear Jonathan's story, I hear a system failure. And the tests give us an opportunity to see how the system is operating and to make determinations about where we need to work differently and have different strategies to meet children where they are. I mean, here, Jonathan's special circumstances of arriving in this country shortly before taking the test means that we've got to do something different with that population. But it doesn't mean that we shouldn't be attentive to looking at each child, what are their skills and knowledge, where are they, and give them the help they need no matter what it takes.
So fix the system.
In effect, fixing the system. And as to the clip you played, I know, you know, if you have a good test, you can have tests that are worth teaching to. You know, I often said to parents, and again, this is a 30-year argument. I have scars on my back from, you know, the 1990s and standing up in defense of saying, you know, asking parents, show me, read the test and tell me what skills and knowledge you don't want your children to learn. If we have a test that asks sophisticated questions and allows for complex answers and gives the students the opportunity to show analytical thinking, that's the kind of test I'd want my children taught to. So I think that Massachusetts has developed some fairly good tests. I don't think graduation should be all about test scores. I don't think it should be a one-time, one-shot-only test. But I do think measuring progress is essential to improvement in any discipline, and we need to continue to measure progress, and we need to have a high standard. Mm-hmm. It's not a question of competing with others so much as it's a question of giving students what they need to be successful.
I'd like to get Jonathan Guzman's take on what Paul just said.
So in particular, when we talk about students across the Commonwealth and we talk about the system failure in this case, right, I feel like when we give the chance for teachers and students to form relationships and have their own curriculum, right, rather than be in a room where they are literally teaching just a memorization within the classroom and preparing students just to pass the test. And that's what I hear from teachers constantly, right? Because the VESE in particular is forgetting about all the knowledge in this world and is demanding the importance about just focusing on the test. Now, when we talk in particular about being fair, right, this in particular is not a joyful learning experience for students. They do not have a cultural appropriation in education. And in particular, this burden to obtain data for the state will begin with class of 2026. And the legislature need to act on this session in particular and be a coming session to make it not a requirement. Like, I understand the particular notion of we need to find something in where we're able to obtain data to understand how districts are doing around the Commonwealth. But this MCAS, the MCAT, the standardized testing, it is not a fair option because it really doesn't develop a structure because every school within the Commonwealth has a different demographics, serves different people, and not everything works the same.
We're talking about the Massachusetts Comprehensive Assessment System, or the MCAS, with Jonathan Guzman here in the studio, vice chair of the Lawrence School Committee, and Paul Revel, also here in the studio, former education system. You were talking about research and data. Research from Brown University is reported by WBUR. It says that even those 91% of students who take the MCAS do pass. However, those who pass with low scores are disproportionately unlikely to complete a four-year college or earn a living wage as adults. So does raising the passing score even matter when it doesn't necessarily mean that you're fully ready for the next step, Paul?
Well, I think that's the heart of the question, Steve. So I'm glad you cited that Brown research because it shows that these test scores actually correlate with future success. But again, it's not about the test scores per se, and it's not about the test. And incidentally, there's a lot of research that will show you that memorization doesn't work on these tests. A teaching practice that instills an approach to learning that has to do with memorization is not going to be successful on math or English. We know that. But the larger question is, if we know that there are certain competencies, certain skills that are necessary for people to be successful. For example, in our community colleges in Massachusetts, roughly two-thirds of the students who have passed MCAS, admitted to community college, need to do remedial work before they can even be admitted to college courses. The MCAS standard, you know, that we're talking about here is a 10th grade standard. Mm. So, and you have multiple chances to pass the test. So I think that what we're doing here is we're setting a high goal, but it's then up to the system to provide students the opportunity to learn. It's not on the students so much as it's on the system to say, if we have students who are a long way from achieving that standard, what are we going to do? How are we going to change the amount of time that students get help? Mm-hmm. For example, in the remedial plan that this calls for, if you're going to go the alternative route, they're now requiring tutoring, mm-hmm. which there's a lot of research to show that tutoring is highly effective. School systems need to make time for that. They've got money now. We're in an unprecedented situation where schools have money from the federal government that allows them to do things that they've never been able to do before. Tutoring is one of the top things that they ought to be doing, and adding time to students' schedules for those who need it to get to the standard.
So it can make some positive changes. Jonathan, we got just about a minute left. The pandemic has made learning much more difficult and impacted progress for many. MCAS scores dropped across categories in the 10th grade test in 2021 compared to the scores of 2019. This is in line with assessment test scores from across the country in this time. Jonathan, is this a matter of not raising scores ever or not raising scores right now?
I think in particular, it's never. I am completely against the MCAS. I believe that the MCAS is not a good measure of student academic knowledge, and rather it's causing a negative impact on students with disability, in particular English learners, BIPOC community, low-income communities, right, and so on. And in particular, it's an overwhelming opposition that we see on different areas from teachers, students, legislators that don't want this to be an actual requirement within Massachusetts. And I feel like in general, people are forgetting that Boston is going through a lot of issues, in particular with the notion of receivership. And one of the things that the receivership law, Chapter 69, says is that a district is placed under chronic underperforming, right? And the measurements that they're looking at, one of them is graduation rates. Mm-hmm.
That was Jonathan Guzman. He's the vice chair of the Lawrence School Committee. Also, Paul Revel is with us today, the former Massachusetts Secretary of Education. Jonathan, Paul, thank you both for coming in today.
Thanks for having us.
Still with us is WBUR education reporter Max Larkin. Max, thanks for sticking around. What are your reactions to what you just heard here?
I had a couple. I thought they both made good points, of course. Paul Revel's remark that this is about fairness was very interesting to me. I think there's this tension, right? Because there's, you know, tens of thousands of students taking this test every year, Steve. And then there's that individual experience that Jonathan spoke to, just this incredible wave of doubt and second guessing that can hold a lot of people back. And so the question is, how do you balance the need to get a look in on how people are learning and, you know, without making people lose faith in their ability to be a good student and accomplish all their goals.
Max, what are you watching for next when it comes to MCAS?
Well, I'll be really interested to hear what the various gubernatorial candidates think. If it's likely that the governor's seat is going to change parties, we could see these decisions get revisited or changed. You know, Pat Jalen told me that legislators who were opposed to this move are upset, but they're regrouping around a strategy. And then we'll have the latest wave of scores, Steve, coming in the next couple months. And I'll be very interested to see whether all the disruptions are still showing up in those scores.
Okay, that's WBUR's education reporter, Max Larkin. Max, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Massachusetts Governor Charlie Baker signed a sweeping law last week meant to address climate change in the Commonwealth. And on Tuesday, President Joe Biden signed the Inflation Reduction Act, which contains more than $360 billion to combat climate change.
This bill is the biggest step forward on climate ever. And it's going to allow us to boldly take additional steps toward meeting all of my climate goals and the ones we set out when we ran.
Both laws aim to help consumers make the switch to electric vehicles. Here to help us understand what it means for residents of Massachusetts, Miriam Wasser, environmental reporter at WBUR. Also with us, Anna Vanderspeck, electric vehicle program director of the nonprofit Green Energy Consumers Alliance. Hi, Miriam. Hi, Anna.
Hey, Steve. Hi.
Thanks for coming in. Miriam, let's start with you. The EPA says that transportation, cars and trucks on the road, made up 27% of the U.S. greenhouse gas emissions as of 2020, more than any other economic sector. So getting people to switch over to electric could have a pretty big impact on our total emissions footprint. Big picture, what are the national and the state laws trying to do both overall and when it comes to electric vehicles?
Yeah, I mean, I think fundamentally what they're both trying to do is lower the barriers to EV adoption. And they both do that through incentives, so tax credits from the federal government and rebates from the state. And, you know, for the first time, these incentives apply to used electric vehicles, which is a really, really big deal for lower and middle income people. And these incentives are now available at the point of sale, which effectively knocks off a lot of money from the sticker price of the car. And these 2 points just have huge equity implications. I talked about this with Joel Levin. He's the executive director of the nonprofit Plug in America, and I think we have a little bit from that conversation.
Already today, if you take an electric vehicle and a gas car and you look at the whole cost of ownership, including maintenance and fuel, because gas is so expensive, EVs for the equivalent car are cheaper. But that's not how people buy cars. People look at the cost of the car up front. And so the whole point of this is to equalize those costs.
Yeah, and Steve, just adding one more thing, that the federal law also has another goal, and that's to spur the domestic manufacturing of EVs. So it has rules aimed to drive a domestic battery supply chain and to disincentivize car manufacturers from using Chinese-made parts and materials.
Keep everything here in the U.S.
Yeah.
Anna, Massachusetts has the ambitious goal of net zero carbon emissions by 2050. And part of that means having an estimated 200,000 EVs on the road by 2025. That's just around the corner. As of now, we have just 51,000 EVs in Massachusetts. Does this get us there? And does it get us in shouting distance even?
It's certainly a step in the right direction. With EV adoption right now, as the quote from Joel Levin talked about, we're waiting for electric cars to be as expensive at the same level as gas-powered cars. And a big part of that is that battery costs have to come down. And different analysts think we'll reach that price parity point sometime this decade. But right now, what's really critical is while there's still that price premium, that we have incentive programs like this from the state and federal level to really kickstart this industry.
Your program helps everyday people make the transition to electric vehicles. I was saying earlier, I've never experienced an electric vehicle yet, and Miriam offered to let me drive hers.
Yeah, come
so
over.
I'm excited about that.
We'll go cruising.
What kinds of incentives are available now, and what changes with these new bills?
Right. So starting at the federal level, right now there is a federal tax credit that's up to $7,500. It depends on the vehicle that you're looking at. So some of them have a slightly smaller federal tax credit. And as of the signing of the Inflation Reduction Act, the vehicle has to have final assembly in the United States to qualify. So I would recommend going to the Alternative Fuels Data Center or the Green Energy Consumers website to see exactly what vehicles qualify for what. But from now until the end of the year, if you purchase an EV, you get some paperwork that you fill out when you do your taxes next year, and you'll get that tax credit. On the state level, there's the state More EV rebate. And right now, it's still the old version. So right now, it is $2,500 for a battery electric vehicle and $1,500 for a plug-in hybrid. So if you're a consumer, you go get an electric vehicle. Once you've gotten the car, you fill out a form on more-ev.org, and then you get a check in the mail sent to you within a couple weeks. But at some point in the next couple of months, that will be updated to reflect the new state climate law.
Let's talk about the practicalities of electric vehicles. Say I got one. Am I going to be able to charge it? Miriam, did these bills help build out the charging infrastructure? How am I going to recharge my vehicle?
So, okay. I don't think charging is as scary as maybe it sounds. But yes, both the state and federal law will help you. We can start with the state one because that's a little bit more straightforward. The law is going to create a single interagency council to oversee the build-out of electric infrastructure. And this is a really big deal because right now it's like spread out just a bunch among a bunch of different agencies, and you kind of need one body overseeing it all. They also have a mandate to make sure that it's built out in an equitable way, meaning we don't end up with public chargers only in affluent areas. And there's a lot of federal money available to help kickstart this program. And then on the federal level, there are big tax incentives for building out charging infrastructure in the Inflation Reduction Act. One is a specific One specific tax credit that's really important is for companies that build chargers in low and moderate income neighborhoods. And then aside from the Inflation Reduction Act, the Biden administration has a lot of policy about this. So the infrastructure bill that passed last year has like a ton, has billions of dollars for coordinated charging and specifically also, again, billions of dollars for building chargers in charging deserts. So I think things are going to get a lot better.
Okay, that's Miriam Wasser, the WBUR environmental reporter. I'm also talking with Anna Vanderspeck, who's the electric vehicle program director for the Green Energy Consumers Alliance. I also want to bring in another voice into this conversation. Martha Grover is the sustainability manager for Melrose. She led an initiative to install EV chargers on utility poles in the city. According to the Environment Massachusetts Research and Policy Center, it's the first program of its kind on the East Coast. Martha, welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
What made you want to undertake this project?
We were approached by National Grid. This was their initiative to run a demonstration pilot project after seeing this equipment demonstrated at a couple of years ago and wanted to see whether they could prove out whether it'd be less expensive to install EV chargers on poles as opposed to traditionally where they're installed in parking lots, ground-mounted installations that often require a lot of trenching and digging to get to the power source. Mm-hmm. So with this option, you're putting it right at the pole.
Sure. How did you decide where to put the pole-mounted chargers? Are they all just on Main Street in Melrose, or are they out in the neighborhoods as well?
No, they are spread out throughout the area. We already had two ground-mounted chargers in our downtown area, so we wanted to make charging accessible to people who live in apartments, who don't have access to charging, who don't have driveways and garages, make the chargers accessible to people who use our recreational areas, parks, playgrounds, sports fields, and also the non-central business districts. So we tried to put them also in other areas that aren't currently being served.
Anna, this program is fascinating because it gets at one of the core problems for moving to electric vehicles. If you own your own home, you can pretty much plug into your garage or your porch. But if you're a renter, you might not have easy access. What's your take on that?
Oh, this is absolutely one of the key barriers holding back EV adoption in Massachusetts, but also anywhere people are looking at EVs. The industry term is garage orphan. If you are not able to install charging at your home, what are you supposed to do? Right now, there is a lot more public charging than people think. So stations like the ones that Martha just described, you can go and charge. But the electric utilities in Massachusetts have actually proposed big plans at the Department of Public Utilities to help multi-unit dwellings install charging like that. Mm-hmm. And we're waiting for an order from the Department of Public Utilities this fall to see what they can do.
Miriam, I want to get your reaction to the program that they have in Melrose. Have you checked it out?
I have not gone to see it yet, but hopefully, Martha, maybe you can show me around. I think it sounds awesome, and I think it's really smart. Joel Levin, who we mentioned earlier that I talked to, was talking about a similar thing. They have a couple hundred of these in LA, and it's in California, and he said it's wildly successful, and it just feels like a really great way to help people who park on the street mm-hmm. be able to adopt an EV.
Martha, what are you hearing from the residents and people who work and visit Melrose about this program?
They love it. These have been in place for a little over a year. We've already had 2,000 charging sessions, 600 just in the last few months. And what I'm hearing is from the people that these are intended for, which are, a woman called me up who lives in an apartment. She'd been thinking about getting an EV, but just couldn't figure out how she was going to charge it. She's a garage orphan. And she saw this down the street, and she went out and bought a used Nissan Leaf for very little money. And now she's charging up a couple blocks from her home, 20 cents per kilowatt hour. That's a few dollars per charge, and getting herself to and from work. And that's exactly what these were intended for. And it's, the use case for these and the goal, I think, for National Grid and their proposal to the Department of Public Utilities is to roll these out, not in the Melroses of the world, the more affluent communities, but now that we demonstrated that they're less expensive, to get these into the Everetts, the Worcesters, Springfields, Lynns, et cetera, where there are a lot of apartment dwellers.
Mm-hmm. Martha and Miriam, you both actually have EVs. Mm-hmm. What has been your experiences trying to keep it charged? Is this doable? Martha, let's start with you.
Well, I can tell you first off, I was surprised when I drove into your garage here this morning, there was no charger there. Mm. That would have been like nice to have.
Yeah. Make a note of that.
Yeah. You know, I charge at home. I charge at work. 80% of charging takes place at home or the office. So, you know, there is definitely a reason to have these publicly available chargers for trips and other instances. But it's very easy, you know, and we're not dependent on garage, you know, gas stations. Mm-hmm. It's very, very flexible.
Miriam, your experience?
Yeah, my husband and I bought a used EV last October, and it's been awesome. I was reading a story not too long ago about how a lot of people have more range anxiety before they actually drive an EV than after they have it. And I think that that's totally relevant to us. I was nervous about, you know, our long car rides to visit family in New Hampshire and New Jersey. And it's really not bad at all.
You made it and you made it back.
Yeah. And we have a baby and, you know, it takes a little bit of advanced planning, but like, yeah, you pull over for an hour and you have lunch and you charge your car. And, you know, most people don't drive 200 miles a day. So for the, you know, you can take care of most of your charging needs at home.
I think we're all EV fans here or want to be fans, but I want to play a little bit of tape from Hiawatha Braid, a technology writer for the Boston Globe and a friend of the show. We asked him about the broader transition to electric vehicles, and he had this to say.
People underestimate how long it's going to take to do this transition. You hear people saying, well, we'll all be driving electric cars in a few years. No, we will not. People will be driving ICE cars for decades to come. Everyone that's leaving an assembly line right now will probably be on the road in 10 to 15 years.
And when he says ICE cars, he's referring to internal combustion engines. What do you say about that, Miriam? Is he right?
Okay, so I have a couple of thoughts about this. And, you know, no disrespect to Hiawatha Braid. I think he's very, very brilliant. But first of all, you guys had him on before the state and federal climate laws passed. So a lot has changed in the last few months, especially the ability to get credits or rebates for used vehicles. Again, that's going to be huge. Related to that, the new Massachusetts law says that you car dealerships will not be able to sell internal combustion engine vehicles. That's a mouthful. After 2035, so that's going to have a big impact.
Okay, that was Miriam Wasser, environmental reporter for WBUR. Also, Martha Grover, sustainability manager for the City of Melrose, and Anna Vanderspeck, the electric vehicle program director of the nonprofit Green Energy Consumers Alliance. Thanks to all.
Thanks, Steve.
Thank you.
Thank you.
When Annette Philip first became a faculty member at Berklee College of Music, she was given what she calls a blank canvas, the space to create something that would celebrate Indian musical traditions and be rooted right here in Massachusetts. She created the Berklee Indian Ensemble, a university class, and then a multinational musical group that has now released its first album. The album is called Shuruat, which means beginnings. I spoke earlier with Annette Philip, the founder-director of the Berklee Indian Ensemble at the Berklee College of Music. I started by asking Annette how it felt to release the album after more than a decade building and developing the ensemble.
It's really surreal. When I got this blank canvas from Berklee in my first year as a young faculty member in 2010, I could never have imagined this is where we would end up. And from a single idea of, you know, having a performing collective to finally having an album and touring and doing workshops around the world and providing scholarships, it's really been a wild and very colorful adventure.
Tell us about the Berklee Indian Ensemble. For those who don't know, what is it and what are your goals?
The Berklee Indian Ensemble was founded in 2011. My idea was to create a space for musicians from all over the world to come together and explore Indian music in all its forms, but also be welcomed to bring their own cultural influences and musical backgrounds into the music that we co-created. Mm-hmm. it really is a family. Mm-hmm. And we've had musicians from 52 countries be part of this movement since 2011.
Terrific. Hey, I want to dive right in with some of the music.
Sure.
They can listen to us, but let's listen to the music. Listen to one. And I should say, if you can, help me out with some of the pronunciations if I don't get it right, okay?
Sure.
Give me an attaboy if I do get it, because okay. This is a little tricky. The song that we're going to listen to is Unai Kanida Nan.
Very close. Unne Kanad Nan.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Let's hear some of that.
ಅಭಿನವನೀತ ಅಭಿನಯ ರಾಜ ಗೋಕುಲ ಬಾಲ ಕೋಟಿ ಪ್ರಕಾಶ ಬಿರಗ ನರಗ ಶ್ರೀ ರಕ್ಷ ಕಮಾಲ ಎತ್ತನೆ ಮುರೇನಾನಿ.
So you can hear this amazing feature of Indian music, this rhythmic solfège. What does it allow you to do having this language that you can share between drummers and dancers?
So in India, we have these ancient musical traditions, and the art forms all are interrelated and synergistic. And so Konnakol is the recitation of rhythmic solfège, just like in Western music you have melodic solfège, do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, ti, do. We have rhythmic solfège where every stroke on a drum correlates to a sound that is recited, which also then has a translation for a dancer's footwork. And it allows you to learn rhythms very quickly. It's very much subdivision based, so it allows you to really embrace and feel in your body odd meters very, very simply. And it's a great brain game and very, very evocative.
Sounds somewhat complex.
It is complex.
Let's listen to another song from the album.
Sundari Penne.
Okay, so this one has kind of a grunge feeling to it. How do you do that, and how do you make a song from a Tamil movie fit with a genre like grunge?
Well, I think the question is, why not? So right from the start, we wanted to make sure that the music that we are exploring represents the people who are making it. Not just that they're coming in to explore Indian music, but they really are themselves within this environment. And so the year that we recorded this, we had a lot of Israeli musicians in the team, and three of them were in a band together, which was a prog rock band. And so as this arrangement came about, there was just this natural tendency to, swoosh into that genre. And we tried to never make an artistic decision just based on a whim. Mm-hmm. It has to really feel like it's an integral part of that song, and it's a natural progression just because of, our personal musical palette.
How do you make space in the classroom, in the studio, for people to bring all kinds of cultural backgrounds to an Indian musical tradition?
So the way that we look at music making and collaboration is that it has to go beyond the piece of music that you're working on. We actually spend a lot of time outside the rehearsals, eating each other's food and learning about each other's culture and watching movies from different parts of the world, watching documentaries, having a lot of debate and discussion and arguments even about things political, sociological, religious, etc. And so the collaboration is deep. It is not just a musical collaboration. It is really different personalities coming together, and you have to make space for that. And when we look at any song, the first thing we look at is, what is the story? What was the original intent of the composer, whether it's an original coming from a member of the Berklee Indian Ensemble or a cover that we're reinterpreting? And who are we as storytellers? And what is the cultural significance for each of us? And that allows people to suddenly think of, this reminds me of this place in Australia where I grew up, and I really want to have this new instrument. Have you tried this? And, when you're open to that, anything can happen.
Let's listen to Lady L. This is a song that pays homage to the Indo-jazz fusion group Shakti.
Mm-hmm.
So Annette Philip, what inspires you about Shakti that you try to bring to your own work?
Well, the playfulness and mischief that you can hear in a lot of their compositions, and at the same time, the deep musicality and deep respect that you can see between the members, both of Shakti and then the group that grew out of it, Remember Shakti. We had the glorious opportunity to play with Ustad Zakir Hussain, who, you know, was on the original recording. It was nerve-wracking for us, but also really inspiring. Similarly with Shankar Mahadevan and John McLaughlin, who were all part of these groups. I think just seeing idols be themselves and be so playful is inspiring to us. And we try to bring that mischief into our playing as well. Mm-hmm.
The other night, in preparation for having you come in today, I downloaded the album from Apple Music and listened to the entire album. It's quite vibrant, and it transported me someplace else. I've never been to India. I don't know if I will ever get there. But I just had that feeling, just closing my eyes and listening, that it transported me there. And I appreciated that, because I don't know when I'm going to get a vacation.
Well, that makes us very happy. And I think that's the goal of all art, to take you somewhere.
Is there something special about Boston that allows you to do something like this?
Well, Boston is the education capital in many ways. There's so many institutions. And I find that people here are curious and inquisitive and adventurous in their, you know, artistic pursuits. And Berkeley itself, I remember the first day I came here as a student, way, way back in 2006, I called my parents and said, this is like an alternate dimension. Like it's some sort of new planet where there are, you know, 6,000 musicians here. Oh my God. So the fact that, you know, Berkeley is headquartered in Boston, but really is a global school and has a global outlook, is such a blessing. And we have over 400 ensembles at the college, of which one is the Berkeley Indian Ensemble. And we've been so supported and encouraged to keep dreaming and be very brave and rogue and, you know, experimental in our work.
Another piece on this album, Pinna, celebrates an unusual figure in Indian literature. Let's listen.
Jaise ki sadaf me shafaf gahar bina takdeer badalne me.
So Annette, the lyrics are from a poem. Tell us about the poet. What about her inspires you about her?
The poem and the song are called Pinha, which is an Urdu word for hidden within. And the poet is from Lucknow, India. And she, the name of the poet is Fatima Vasia Jaisi. And she was always interested in writing and literature from a young age. But, you know, beyond regular schooling, she hadn't, you know, put much effort into it. And after marriage, she was encouraged to do a master's. And after she had children, she actually did a PhD and then went on to write 11 books. And many people in her life really saw that hidden talent within her and encouraged her. And in those days, it wasn't very common for women. I mean, this is the 1940s, 1950s, for women in India to really take up a career as an author full time. And she paved the way for many women in her region. And so that's very inspiring for us.
We just have to listen to one more from this album. This is a little bit called Sati.
Sati rati rati ra. Sati rati rati ra.
So Annette, did you really record this separately during the pandemic?
Absolutely. Not a single person was in the same room at the same time.
Did that change? I mean, when the pandemic came along, having to be apart, was that so unique to music and what you do?
Well, to this group, yes. To, you know, other projects, maybe not. And I'm grateful for the maybe not aspect, because most of the people involved have their own home studio or are very, you know, used to doing studio recordings remotely or isolated. So that was good. But for us, it's always been about being together in a room. So this was interesting, and I'm really happy with how it turned out. It's pretty powerful, at least for us.
Sure. How do you find that sense of cohesion when you're not all in the same place?
We have a very clear idea of where the song is going, the arc, the emotional and musical arc of the song. And we really communicate and are not afraid to, you know, make mistakes and start over. So I think that's been a lot of the work here.
I know you put a lot of work into an equitable revenue sharing model for this record. Tell us about that.
Thank you for asking about this. In the music industry, there are lots of artists who, A, don't know what their rights are, and B, don't know how to stand up for those rights. And we were really decisive that this project must be fair and respectful to all the contributors, not just the performers, but also the producers, arrangers, engineers, etc. And so we've designed a system through Berkeley to make sure that every person on the album, all 98 musicians and the additional crew, is able to share in the revenue for life. And we're really hoping that this becomes the norm in the industry as opposed to an exception.
Mm-hmm. Has anybody else tried it since you, or is this just still so new?
Well, it's not new in all respects, but I think for an educational institution where usually if a student participates in a recording, it's considered experiential learning. And for us, we felt that the intention when some of these songs was recorded was never to release it, but the intention changed. And if the intention has changed, then the modus of operation must also change. Even if it's hard, even if it's time consuming, it just has to be done. And we have to, as an educational institution, set an example, set a precedent. So the hope is that this has a ripple effect. And if anyone is interested, we are so excited to talk about it, but probably not here. But yeah.
What's next for you and the Berkeley Indian Ensemble?
Well, we will submit this album, Shuruat, for the Grammys. In fact, I'm working on that. The deadline is the end of August. We also just got to know that we have booked a festival in India. It's one of the largest festivals in India happening in November this year. And we're hoping to do a tour in India, plus a world tour, probably 23, 24. And the biggest dream of all, we would love to do a stadium show or a tour of stadium shows. Because why not?
That was Annette Philip, founding director of the Berkeley Indian Ensemble. Annette, thank you.
Thank you.
Let's go out on a little more from the album. This is five-piece band from the Berkeley Indian Ensemble's new album, Shuruat. And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Chris Siderick, Amanda Beeland, and Sydney Bowles, with Bart Tocci and Andrea Perdomo. Marquise Neal is our senior technical director. Titus Folladoon is our executive producer. I'm Steve Brown. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.